How are we doing today? Good? How in the world can you all just go right after singing those songs and being in church and you guys are alive and we don't live in South Dakota? Let's try this again. How are we doing today? Good? All right. Hey, if I haven't gotten a chance to meet you, my name is Caleb, and I spoke here last week, and we're in a series called Messy Grace, and then I'm speaking next week, and then the good thing is that you're done with me after next week, okay? You'll have Pastor Ken back. The bad news is you won't have the kind of eye candy you've been looking at for the past 3 weeks, but still, you're going to have my friend Pastor Ken back, and I look forward to him coming back, and I know that God is obviously speaking some things into his heart, and I can't wait for him to share that with you, and I can't wait to hear it as well. You know, with what I do a lot, I fly, and there's, you know, I talked about flying and kind of how I don't like it, and it's not that I'm afraid I'm going to die. You know, if I do fly and if I do die, it's a good way to go. You know, you pass out before you hit the ground. The pressure of the plane and everything pummeling down, I'm in, you know. It's a good way to go. But why I don't like to fly, and I did it this week, was because of people. People are nasty on commercial airliners on a regular basis, okay? And people are also very, very interesting on commercial airliners. And so I remember not too long ago, I was sitting down, and I was reading my Bible in the aisle seat because that's my seat. You know, you get up, you can use the bathroom. Something happens, you get out of the plane first, and so on and so forth. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm just, you know, reading my Bible as people are getting on and everything. Then some guy gets in the middle seat, sits down next to me, and he's like, what are you, a Christian? And I'm like, oh, it's going to be a fun conversation. I half toyed with the notion of speaking an accent to him, saying, yes, I love the Lord, and I sell insurance. Which one do you want to talk about? Because I figured that would shut him up pretty quick, you know. He doesn't want to talk about either one. But I just answered, yeah, I believe in Jesus. He's like, oh, so you're one of those Christians. And I'm like, well, it depends on what you mean by those Christians. He's like, well, you're one of the ones that think that, you know, everything is going downhill, you know, and the people are bad and the people are getting worse. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I am one of those. It's exactly what I believe. I'm one of those Christians. And he said, well, I have to disagree with you. I don't think people are that bad. I said, really? No. People are good. People aren't that bad. And I was like, huh. I said, do you mind if we talk about this a little bit? He's like, sure. I was hoping. And I said, oh, yeah, good, fun. I said, do you know how many people were murdered between China and Russia in the 1900s and the 20th century? Do you know how many? He's like, how many? Between the two countries, 120 million people were killed. That's not counting wars, by the way. We're talking about killed, murdered, slaughtered, that kind of thing. And that's not counting all the other countries. That's not counting our countries. It's not counting the other countries. I said that's not counting other issues that we have to deal with, like human trafficking and rape. That's not counting the difficulties that we see spreading throughout the world because of selfishness. I said, you know, I just look at it, and people are just not that good. I mean, how in the world can you say the people deep down inside are good when you have 120 million in the 1900s between those two countries? And he said, well, aside from that, people are good. I'm like, oh, okay. We're just going to push all that to the side. Aside from that, people are good. I said, can I ask you another question? He said, sure. I said, do you lock your doors at nighttime? He said, well, of course. I said, why do you lock your doors? He's like, well, I don't want anybody taking my stuff. I said, no, you said people are good. Remember, you shouldn't have to lock your doors at nighttime. If people are that good, leave your front door open at 2 in the morning. Put all your stuff out on your porch. People are good. They're not going to touch it. Put your money out there, right? Put all that stuff out there. He's like, well, that's not the same thing. I said, how is that not the same thing? If you don't trust people enough to the point where you're locking your doors when you go to sleep at nighttime, then you are being a hypocrite. People are really not that good. Now, people can be nice. People can be moral. But you put any one person in a certain set of circumstances, and I guarantee you that every single person in here is capable of doing something that you never thought you would ever do, given the right circumstances. And I said, this is why, one of the reasons why I am a Christian. Because I know I'm not that good. I feel it inside of myself all the time. And I bet if some of you are honest, you do too. Right? You feel that inside. Every single person in here is only one bad decision away from ruining your life. One. And I said, I need Jesus because I can't live my life on my own. When I try to live my life on my own, bad things happen. And I said, that's why I'm a Christian. Not because I think I'm better than everyone, but because I think I'm worse than most people. He didn't talk much after that. I tried to engage him a little bit more, but I'm not going to go down with this whole thing of, oh, people are good. No, I've seen too much stuff, and some of you have seen too much stuff to know deep down inside people are that. And you know what? I think most of us know that. I think it's a pipe dream when we say that people are really good. And I think that we start giving into fear. You see, I tell people all the time, fear is not a bad thing. Fear is a good thing. It is a constant companion in life. You need fear. If you go out hiking after this in the mountains, and you're walking down the trail, and there's a rattlesnake in front of you, okay, you should be afraid. You should not go up and say, I want to pick it up and cuddle it, and I want to pet it and put a collar on it and call it Betsy, and I want to put it in my pocket and sling it over my shoulder, and, oh, it's now my pet. Okay, first of all, you're a moron if that's what you want to do, okay? Second of all, there's something inside of you that kind of jumps back, and you're like, I don't want to touch it. I don't want to mess with it. I'm going to let it do its thing, and I'm going to do my thing, right? That kind of fear is not bad. But when fear starts leading your life and directing the decisions that you're making, people, that is a recipe for disaster. Fear will give you permission, ultimately, to do horrible things to individuals, left and right. Okay? We naturally fear whatever it is that we don't understand or whatever it is that makes us feel out of control. So when you meet a people group, a person, a circumstance, or an idea that you don't understand or makes you feel out of control, you react with fear. And if you start allowing your life to be led by fear, you will hurt people. As one of my mentors said to me a while ago, you may have known him. You probably do. He's a short guy, really just ugly as all get out. No, he really, you can laugh at that. You know, trust me, you're going to want to laugh in a second. He is ugly as all get out, really wrinkly, white hair, big ears, green. His name is Yoda. One time, I remember he said in one of the Star Wars movies that fear is a path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, and hate leads to suffering. Fear will give you permission to do horrible things to people. Fear will give you permission to live in a false dichotomy where we are either on one side or the other. We only think that we have a voice in our society unless we're an extremist on this side or on that side. Now, if you remember last week, I talked about messy grace, kind of told you a little bit about my story, told you about how Jesus lived in this tension of grace and truth, and told you about the rubber band illustration, if you remember, how there are some people that just live on the grace side or some people that live on the truth side, and that's like the most un-Christ-like thing you could do. Because John 1:14 and 17 say that Jesus Christ came full of both grace and truth at the same time. But yet, what gives us the right to take sides between the two? And there's no power. But yet, when I say I'm all about the grace and the truth, where does the power lie? The power lies in the tension of the two. And you feel this tension all the time. And yet, people, when they give in to fear, they automatically go to their muscle habit. If they're all about the grace, it takes no work on your part to be all about the grace. Or if you're all about the truth, it takes no effort to be all about the truth. Okay? It takes you facing your fear and getting to know people. If you're about the truth, to stretch over here to the grace, and it takes all the faith in the world and you overcoming your fear and really looking at the human condition, if you're all about the grace, to stretch over to the truth. And so today, I want us to talk about the grace side of things. Next week, when we conclude, we're going to talk about the truth side of things. And I don't even like to say the grace side, the truth side, but for lack of a better phrase or example, that's what I mean. We're going to talk about grace today. We're going to talk about truth tomorrow. Or, I mean, next Sunday. Well, no, I mean, if you're here tomorrow, I won't be. But next Sunday, we're going to. And so to start off, last week we looked at Jesus. Today we're going to look at Jesus. And next week, we again are going to look at Jesus. And in this one particular scene in which we're looking at Jesus today, Jesus is actually having dinner at a Pharisee's house, a very wealthy man. And this Pharisee had all these friends over. And all these friends are all, like, wealthy, and which is not a bad thing. They just were, because you only hung out with your own economic status back in those days. As much as you think that's true today, you have no idea how true that was in the first century. And so they're all having dinner. They're all hanging out. Everybody seems to be having a good time, but everybody is sucking up to the guest, okay? You ever been invited somewhere by somebody important, and you get there, and you just know the people that are clamoring for attention and spots, they're the ones who are just kind of like all the time when you see them, they're moving closer and closer like an assassin to the person that they want to get close with or they want to be able to talk to. Some of you are laughing because you know exactly what I'm talking about. When you're at a company function and the boss is there, there's always that one person that's going to go up and start talking to him. And you're like, oh, drop a house on your sister, I hope. And so Jesus basically tells them, hey, you don't want to do that. You don't want to seek chief seats. They don't get it, because one guy basically in so many words says, hey, I can't wait till we get to the new heavens and new earth. We don't have to put up with this. Jesus doesn't like snide remarks. Last week we talked about how you should never argue with him. Rule number two about Jesus, he doesn't like snide remarks about other people. He stands up for other people. So when this individual says this, Jesus decides to tell a parable. Now, a parable, if you're not familiar, is basically, it's pretty easy to understand. It is a story that Jesus tells, and it is usually has exaggerated elements to it, as we're going to see, and it has one point, and it involves usually everybody that Jesus is around and always has God in the parable. So a parable is basically a fancy word for a story, for metaphor, for hyperbole, something like that. And so Jesus decides to tell one of his parables. By the way, parables are not historic. Most of us believe that they are stories that Jesus made up in that moment to talk about these things, to make his point. Because, I mean, they were very much in the oral tradition in the first century. Anytime somebody told a story, everybody's like, oh, you know how some of you have kids, you have grandkids, you know, you want them to really pay attention to something, you put it on the phone, right? You put it on the iPad. And even if you don't, you know what I'm talking about. You've been out to eat before, you see kids are like this. In the first century, when somebody would begin to tell a story, you know, people would be like, ugh, like that. And so Jesus really knew he could have their attention. And so we're going to take a look at the story that Jesus tells here. He begins in Luke 14. And if you don't have your Bibles or your mobile devices, you can just listen along with me as I read this. Luke 14, beginning with verse 16. It says, a certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. Okay? Now, let's just stop right there. This certain man, whoever he is, he's very wealthy. And I can tell you why. Number one, in the first century, most individuals only lived in a one-room house. Okay? One room. Some of you are like, that describes my life right now. But you did everything in this one room. You ate dinner in there. You slept in separate corners. You did homework in there. everything happened in this one room. Okay, and the economic status back then, most people, as we're going to see, were just in this one, you know, in this kind of situation with just one room. So the fact that this guy has enough room to invite guests means that he's got a really big house. And besides that, we also know he's wealthy because he invited many guests. And as we're going to see in a second, he has a servant. So this guy, you know, there's the 1%. Okay, then there's the 0.0001%. That's where this guy is, right here. Let's go on right here. It says in verse 17, at the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. Okay, now look at verse 18. This is where people's jaw would drop when they heard Jesus say this. They'd be like, no way. But they all alike began making excuses. The first said, I've just bought a field and I must go see it. Please excuse me. Another said, I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me. And still another said, I just got married, so I can't come. Okay. This is what I'm about to give you. Side note, ADHD moment. Free advice. You don't even have to tithe for this. Okay. If you invite somebody over to your house or out to dinner or to hang out, and their excuse to you is, I can't come because I just bought 5 yoke of oxen, they're lying. They don't like you. As true as that, as funny and as weird as it was, you know, today, it would have been more so back then. People heard that. They would have been like, oh, are you kidding? Somebody actually said that? What a slap in the face. Like, you would never do that. Okay, now, you remember how I said the economic status back then was just kind of like really weird? Because you had people who were wealthy, about this percentage of people. Then you had people in the middle class, about this percentage. And then everybody else, like lower class, poverty, and beyond poverty, was like this. And so usually it was taboo back then to talk to and spend time with people who are not in your economic status. And so you know who he would have invited? His friends and his family. There were not that many people up here in the wealthy category. Just a few. So these are the people that he knows. These are the people that he's spending time with. And they all say no. It would be like you, if you think about your best friend or people that you're close with or your family or something. You invite them somewhere, and they say, you know what? No. It would be like if you and I knew each other real well, and you said, Caleb, you want to go out to eat dinner? And I'd be like, you know what? I'm washing my hair. I'd love to. I'm washing my hair. Or maybe I might say, I'd love to, but, you know, I've got practice with the Lakers. You're just going to look at that. You're going to be like, that's an excuse. AKA, they don't like you. And so, in verse 21, it says that the servant came back. This is what Jesus says. The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, go out quickly into the streets and alleys of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Now, remember when I said that people's jaws were dropped open at first when Jesus said, hey, when these people said, you know, we're not going to come. When the master says, go out and invite the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame, their jaws would have hit the ground. Because now we're crossing economic barriers. You didn't do that back then. And what's really interesting, if you look at the original language and some of these words right here, like the word poor, it doesn't just mean poor, somebody who doesn't have money. It can also be translated as somebody of little value. You ever feel like that? You ever have somebody make you feel like that? Where you don't have that much value? And all of a sudden you don't feel like you're in or you're part of anything? I think many of us have been there. Do you know somebody like that? And then this word right here, the crippled. I mean, literally, people that take time getting around. People who have been in difficult accidents. people who struggle to make it. Okay, the blind doesn't just mean blind. The blind can mean people who are slow to perceive. People who don't feel that intelligent. You ever feel like that? I never realized how much I felt like that until I got married. I love my wife, I really do. I go 5 miles over the speed limit, and she talks to me like I'm a moron. Do you realize you're going 5 miles over the speed limit? Yep. Then like 2 minutes later, you're still going 5 miles over the speed limit. Oh, I didn't realize that was a command. I'm sorry. Some of us are slow to perceive, but some of us really have been made to feel like that. And then what's really interesting is this word lame right here doesn't just mean lame. It can also mean people who were born with disorders, people who were born with disabilities, people that make some other individuals feel uncomfortable. That's what lame can mean right here. So yeah, these can very definitely be physical ailments, but they can also be seen as ailments, you know, within ourselves that make other people in society uncomfortable, and yet these are the people that get pushed to the side. And so he tells the servant to go into the streets and the alleys. The streets would have been where the middle class was. And the alleys, this is where the no class was. This is where you went if you didn't have money. This is where you went if you felt like you had little value. And this guy says, I want you to get all these individuals and invite them and bring them into my house. Okay? Verse 22. Sir, the servant said, what you have ordered has been done, but there is still room for more. Remember how I said the average house was like one room? Remember how I said that parables back in the first century, they were very, very exaggerated with their details? Well, in one town, you could have anywhere between 500 on average to 1,000 individuals living in it. And very few of them were wealthy. So for this guy to be able to fit between 500 to 1,000 people in his house, now do you get what I'm saying about exaggeration? You'd be hard-pressed to find a house like that right now, anywhere in our country. No, I'm sure there are some, but very few. And at this point, people are like, oh, come on, that's, you know, whatever. But it just shows you the extravagant grace and abundance of God. And that God's doors are not closed in the face to people. It doesn't matter your economic status. It doesn't matter what other people think of you. It doesn't matter their opinion of you. How about this? It doesn't matter your opinion of you. Because some of you are horrible to yourself. You think negative thoughts about yourself all the time. And if you had a friend that talked to you the way that you talk to yourself, you wouldn't be that person's friend, would you? It just got real, didn't it? But this master, he's not done yet. Kind of like God, which, remember how I said God is the central figure in the parables? Maybe you figured out that this guy is representative of God. He goes even further because God's grace, once you think it's done reaching people, it goes further than what you know. And it always, hear me out on this, it always makes you feel uncomfortable. If you ever start feeling comfortable with the grace of God, you're not really experiencing the grace of God. The grace of God sometimes makes you go, really? It's like, you remember, like some of you are going to remember this, some of you are not. Some of you will Google this later on. This is a serial killer named Jeffrey Dahmer, who killed a lot of people. Apparently when he was in prison, he became a Christian. And there was a lot of evidence to prove that he did. And then he was beaten to death in prison. And then when people would you know, I would talk to people and I'd be like, well, he's a Christian, or I hear other people say, well, he's a Christian, you know, he's in heaven. People are like, oh, there's no way that guy's in heaven. After everything that he's done, there's no way that he's in heaven. You know what that tells me? That tells me you just are facing an aspect of God's grace that makes you feel uncomfortable, and now you're beginning to understand the grace of God. I remember the same thing with Ted Bundy on his last interview. You can go to YouTube and watch it. Another serial killer. I don't watch serial killers. I'm just trying to pick something that would make people feel uncomfortable. I'm doing a good job of it. But the night before he was executed, he did a long interview with Dr. Dobson. Focus on the family. You can watch on YouTube. Now, the thing with Bundy was he's a prolific liar, so you don't know. But with Dahmer, it seemed like it. You know, what if Kim Jong-un became a Christian? Exactly. Some of you say hallelujah. Some of you are like, argh. When you start feeling uncomfortable, that's when you know that you're starting to feel the impact of God's grace. This is what the master says in verse 23. Go out to the roads and the country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house will be full. I tell you that not one of those who were invited would get a taste of my banquet. Whereas everybody's jaw would have dropped at first when the people said, no, I'm not coming. Everybody's jaw would have hit the ground when the master said, invite the rest of the town. Now everybody would have had an aneurysm and died when they heard this. Because when Jesus says, go out to the roads and the country lanes, he's saying, go outside the city limits. Go outside the country boundaries. In other words, AKA, bring in the people that aren't Jewish. Which is interesting in the original language. The country lanes right here can literally mean like walls and hedges that you build. It paints this picture in the original language of walls and hedges that you build to protect yourself from other people because you've been so hurt. Ever been there? Where you've just been hurt by people, you put up walls, you're like, I don't want to trust other people, especially people like from my own community or tribe, I hate that word, or fellowship. I don't want to trust. And so you wall yourself off. You don't ever really let somebody get that close because you've been too hurt. And Jesus says, I want the people who are not, hear me, I want those people who are not one of us in here. In other words, not only does Jesus say, we're going to cross economic boundaries, Jesus says, we are going to cross racial boundaries. As I said last week, when you follow Jesus, you do not get the right to be racist or hurt people or discriminatory or prejudiced. You do not get that right. If you keep on doing that, you've really got to ask yourself if Jesus Christ has really pierced your heart or not. Because it says, and by the way, if you are racist, two things. You know, one, you do realize that you're in a religion led by a Jewish carpenter, so, right? I hate to break the news to you. There is that. And you don't want to look at Revelation 7:9, like the new heavens and the new earth. You might want to skip heaven, because you won't like it there. Because it says that every tongue, tribe, and nation will be before the throne of the Lamb. And how God celebrates ethnic diversity. He created it. He celebrates it in heaven. If you're racist, like, you might want to take a hard pass on Christianity. Or you can let Jesus lead you to repentance. Hear me out on this. This is a very important principle. If you want to live out and live in the tension of grace and truth, which is love, if you want to live in messy grace, you've got to understand the main principle, the main point of this passage, of this parable that Jesus is telling us, and it's this, that out-of-place people always have a place with God. Out-of-place people always have a place with God. What kind of people? people. You people, all of you, I'm looking at you right now. I need more participation. Listen, my friend Rudy Haygood, and you know Rudy? He's come here, he's preached, he's like, they don't always talk back to you, Caleb. So we're going to work on this a little bit. What kind of people? There you go. Out of place people, or I like how some of you said peoples. Out of place people always have a place with God. Out of place people always have a place with God. If you are here this morning and you feel out of place, you are in the right place. You are in a place where everybody else has issues. Look at all the people around you. Just look to your left, look all around real quick. Look all around. If you're married to the person, don't look at them. Look at everybody else. Okay? We done got some issues in here. Every single person you see is messed up. We all have bad days and good days, bad seasons and good seasons, bad weeks, good weeks. We are all messed up and we all have issues, but we come to this place called First Christian Church, Newberry Park. We come here to be able to follow Jesus together, and we link arms no matter where you are in your spiritual journey. This is a place where it's okay not to be okay. Because out of place people always have a place with God. A couple things with this. Like, how do I live that principle out? What does that look like? Let me give you one just really nugget here that I want you to hold on to. And it's this. You've got to embrace the difference between acceptance and agreement. If you want to be gracious towards those with whom you disagree, those who make different decisions than you, those who come from places that you dislike, those who work for companies that you would never work for, those who have made decisions that you would never make, how do you do that? How do you love the people that voted for the candidate you never would without thinking that person is of the devil? How do you do that? You have to realize that there is a big difference between acceptance and agreement. Okay? You are commanded by God to accept people. That does not mean you have to agree with everything that somebody believes or affirm every decision somebody's made or approve of every opinion or relationship that somebody is in. But you are called to accept people. And some of you are like, Caleb, I'm not sure about that. Well, first of all, in the parable that Jesus told here, when all these people gather together in the master's house, and even the people from the other, you know, from outside of the country, the people who are not Jewish, the people who are probably of religions that the master was not? Do you think that the master agreed with that? No. But the master let them in because the master wanted to have influence with them. And the master wanted to celebrate. Just because you don't agree with somebody doesn't mean you write them off. Jesus says something very, very similar. And what I think is the most challenging, passage in the entire Bible. Some people are like, Revelation is the hardest passage book of the Bible to understand, or Romans 9 through 11. That's child's play compared to Matthew 5, 38 through 48. You want to be really challenged? Go read Matthew 5, 38 through 48. Go read Romans 9 or Romans 12, 9 through 18. Jesus says in Matthew 5, 41, if somebody forces you to go with them 1 mile, go with them two. In the first century, Roman soldiers could force Jewish people to carry their pack for a mile. These people who were led by a pagan dictator came into their country, occupied their country illegally, imposed taxes that they didn't agree with, restricted some of their religion, killed some of their family and brethren. You know what Jesus said? Serve them. Mile one is about obligation. Mile two is about the relationship. And then he says this, because he knew that people were scowling at him. In Matthew 5:43, you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Wait a minute, you want me to love the Roman soldier who killed my brother? Jesus would have said, yes. I don't think Jesus would have said, just write it off, it's okay. It doesn't matter, right? Who cares? You know, it doesn't matter, just get on board. He never said, write off the wrong. He said, walk with someone. Let me put this in today's language. You want me to love somebody who wrote something I disagree with on social media like Facebook? Yep. Jesus would say, yeah. I know it's tough. Yeah. You want me to not make assumptions about the way somebody is because of who they voted for? Yep. I want you to think deeper about people, not differently about theology. That's what Jesus would have said. Jesus goes on to say in verse 46, if you only love those who love you, what reward will you get? Anyone can do that. It takes zero effort on your part to love people who are just like you or people who do things for you. Case in point, if after this service we're talking and I give you $500,000, just say, hey, it's yours. I already paid all the taxes on it. It's yours. You're probably going to be my friend. Right? Probably going to take me out to lunch. I would assume. And those of you who aren't laughing or lying right now, you know you would. If you gave me $500,000, dude, I'd be over at your house every night giving you a foot rub. Every night. It takes no effort for me to like you if you do something for me. It takes all the faith in the world for me to love you if you're nothing like me. It takes all the effort in the world for us to stretch from one side to the other to make sure that out-of-place people feel like they have a place with God. Because people that... The alternative is horrible. I told you last week that everything we do should be to have influence with somebody so that we listen for the right time when we can share Jesus with someone. You were not saved for yourself. You were saved to help Jesus meet other people. And if you and I are not consistently investing in the lives of others, if we are not helping out-of-place people find their place with God, we are misappropriating the blood of Christ. I'm going to close with this. I told you last week, my mother's partner, she and my mom were together for 22 years. Vera had cancer, and she ended up dying of cancer. And I remember... In February 2005, I got a call from my mom, and she said, Caleb, if you want to say goodbye to Vera, this is probably your time. Now, Vera and I, you know, you read my book, Messy Grace, you're going to see it real quick. It's no secret, we did not get along. But at the same time, this woman practically raised me. She still meant something to me, and I still loved her. And so I flew out to Kansas City, and I made a deal with God. And I know you're not supposed to, but I figured he was cool with it. And I said, God, if you give me the opportunity to share Jesus with Vera, okay, I'm going to trust you will. I'm not going to force the conversation. I'm just going to wait. And so I got to my childhood home, and my mom had transformed our dining room into a hospice room that Vera was in. And the cancer, Vera had chosen not to have treatment, and so she was on hospice. They were trying to keep her as comfortable as possible, and the cancer was taking her pretty quickly. And that she was in and out of consciousness, and so we would always take turns. Somebody would be with her, sit with her most of the night or most of the morning, most of the afternoon. And so I'm there like 4 days, and on the fourth night, the very last night, the next day I'm going home, I'm sitting with Vera late at night, taking the night shift. And God hadn't opened up the opportunity yet. Have you ever really kind of gotten frustrated at God because, like, he's not playing ball? And you're like, I thought this was going to happen. You know, I've been waiting. I've been praying. And it didn't happen. And then finally, like, after I'm, you know, just kind of having it out with God in my head, I'm like, I'm just going to talk to her. God, if you're not going to do this. She opened up her eyes, and I kid you not, looked at me and said, Caleb, what do you think is on the other side? And I said, Vera, Jesus is. And if you trust Jesus with your life right now, the same grace that saves you now will carry you into the next life. So, and, you know, I told her verses like Romans 8:1, therefore there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And she looked at me, and she said, no. And she said, no, because I think people like you, Christians, I think you're weak. And I think you use Jesus as a crutch. And I'm still trying to help her see the light. And I said, well, then you're spot on. You're halfway to being a Christian already because I am weak. I can't live my life on my own, like I said in the beginning of the sermon, because I know who I am, and I'm learning more about who I am, but here's the deal. He is not my crutch. He is my wheelbarrow, okay? He's driving the car. I'm not even in the back seat. I'm in the trunk, and he's got me bound with gray duct tape and gagged and chloroformed because I cannot live my life on my own. I need Jesus to live my life for me. And unless a miracle happens, which I don't count that out, I don't live by that, but I don't count it out in these situations, she went to go face the Father without Jesus by her side. And it hurt me. And over again, I would think about my childhood, and there are so many people that continued to make her and my mother feel further out of place by the way they talked, by the way they treated her, with the words that they said. Hear me out on this, people. Out of place people always have a place with God. Your role in the parable, if God is the master, you are the servant, delivering the invitations to let people know that Jesus Christ has died for them. You see, this is one of the reasons why we take communion every week at our church, as we're going to do in just a second. Because when we take the little cup and the little chiclet bread, and when we take these things and when we eat them and when we drink, we are reminded of Jesus's death, burial, and resurrection for us. So that we don't have to live our life on our own. That he died to give us out-of-place people a place. And so, if this is one of your first times here, welcome. We're glad that you're here. Don't feel compelled to take communion. If you don't feel like you want to, just let it pass. And if you're in a place where you're just trying to figure some things out and you don't feel comfortable taking it, just let the plate pass. I mean, many of us are going to do that. But for those of us who are taking communion, and even for those of us who are not, use this time to ask God, number one, thank God for what he's done in your life. Number two, ask him to reveal somebody in your life right now that you need to invest in who feels out of place so you can show them they have a place with God. Maybe even that you can bring them to this place. I'm going to pray, and then we'll take communion. Lord, thank you so much for this opportunity. Thank you for communion. Thank you for your son, Jesus Christ. Thank you that his death has actually prepared a place for all of us because sin has put us out of place. Lord, may we never think more of ourselves than we should, and may we continually invest in our relationship with you and our relationship with others. It's in your son's name I pray. Amen.